Welcome to the Project Zion podcast. This podcast explores the unique spiritual and theological gifts Community of Christ offers for today's world.
Welcome to Cup of Joe, where we explore restoration history from a Community of Christ perspective. I'm your host, Karen Peter. And for many people who grew up in Community of Christ, or formerly the RLDS Church, we learned the early history of the church, the people and places from Palmyra, New York, to Kirtland, Ohio, and on to Nauvoo, Illinois. And then we just kind of skipped ahead to Independence, Missouri, and the current expression of the church. Or maybe I just did that, but I'm guessing others did too. But it only tells part of the story when we focus on what happened in the United States. And we don't always get to hear how the church developed in places outside of the United States. So today, we're really happy to have with us our guest, Peter Judd. Peter served the Community of Christ as a full-time minister from 1971 to 2005. And he served in a number of capacities, including as a member of the Council of 12, and a member of the First Presidency. Peter's a native of Enfield, England. He received a Bachelor of Arts in Religion and Business Administration. Boy, that came in handy for some times, didn't it? Business Administration from Graceland College in Lamoni, Iowa. A Master of Arts in Economics from the University of Kansas in Lawrence, Kansas. And a Master of Divinity and a Doctor of Ministry from the St. Paul School of Theology in Kansas City, Missouri. And Peter, I did not put this in my notes, but sometime we're going to have a conversation, as you were one of the early church employees that received their Doctor of Ministry, and that would make a whole nother podcast. Peter's authored or co-authored 8 books and a number of articles, pamphlets, study resources, and other publications for the church. He's married to Chris Judd. He has 2 daughters and 3 granddaughters. Now, Peter retired in 2005, but he continues to serve the church in a volunteer capacity as a writer, an editor, and ministries consultant. And so we are really happy you're here. Hi, Peter.
Hi, Karen.
So can you tell us just a little bit more? I gave kind of the biographical statistics, but tell us a little bit about yourself so our listeners can get to know you, kind of where you are, how you got there, if you have any hobbies or interests, or how delightful your grandchildren are. Anything that would help us get to know you better.
Okay, thank you. Well, this is a wonderful opportunity for me to be able to share with you a little bit about the background of the church in the British Isles. As Karen indicated, I'm a native of England. That's where I was born and raised. And I was born there into the RLDS Church. By that, I mean I have a long family heritage. Now, Community of Christ, of course. And my heritage goes back to my great-great-grandmother, who joined the RLDS Church in 1879. As I was growing up in the Enfield, England congregation, and Enfield is just a little north of London that's in the south part of England, we would receive visits from a number of people from the USA, members of the RLDS Church, and they would come because they were there on vacation or on business, or perhaps in some cases there were families of military personnel who were stationed for a while in the UK. And they would talk to us about life in the US. And several of them would say to persons who were teenagers that the church had a college in the US, and they would encourage us to think about how we might benefit from such an experience of attending the Graceland College. So as I was completing my regular education in grammar school, that's the equivalent of the U.S. high school, I began to think about that rather seriously, and I made application and got my passport and visa for entry in the U.S., and in August of 1961, I embarked on a very lonely 4.5-day trip by ocean liner from southern part of England to New York City. And then I spent almost 24 hours on a Greyhound bus getting to Kansas City from there. And I was 18 years old. Even though I spoke the same language, or at least a similar language, I guess, being in the U.S. and at Graceland was something of a culture shock for me, but I adapted. And even though I've visited my homeland of England many, many times since, and I just love it, I've found my home ever since in the U.S. You asked, Karen, about hobbies or areas of interest. Well, my family, you mentioned I have 2 daughters and 3 granddaughters. They live fairly close in Kansas City, Missouri, where I live. I enjoy reading. I enjoy particularly reading British history, studying Community of Christ history. And more recently, I've got into family genealogy and the combination of that and the church development in southern England.
So you have a wide variety of interests. And I understand from my friendship with Chris that you also enjoy rambling around old buildings, lighthouses, and churches when you travel home and around the United States.
Yes, we do, particularly back in England where everything is so old. I do remember saying, kind of impressing my Graceland friends when I arrived there, I would say two things to them, that the house in which I lived had 4 fireplaces, and they thought I lived in a mansion, but that was just a standard thing for the homes. They were pretty average back in those days. And then the other thing I told them, which was true, is that the school that I attended celebrated its 400th anniversary while I was in attendance there. We had a big celebration for that. I like things old.
Well, we don't have a lot of things that are 400 years old in the United States, so I'm sure that was quite impressive and made you stand out in a lot of people's minds. Well, Peter, you are the perfect person to talk to us a little bit about our topic today, which is the history of the church in the British Isles. And I asked you, how do I go about referencing this geographic area when we talk about it? Do I say UK or Great Britain or England and Wales? What do I say?
Well, it's interesting. The current terminology of the United Kingdom of the full term is Great Britain and Northern Ireland. The United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland consists of the one large island, which in itself consists of England, Wales, and Scotland, and the northern part of an adjacent smaller island, which is called Northern Ireland. Now, the British Isles term, which is often used also, consists of Ireland itself, that's the rest of the island of Ireland. But there are a number of smaller islands around. But just as Canadians don't like to be lumped in with people from the US, you know, under the term Americans, so it is that people from Wales particularly, but also Scotland and Northern Ireland, don't like to be referred to as English. So we have to be rather careful about that. But anyway, so I'll use those different references as we continue the conversation.
Okay, and based on which reference you use, we'll try to keep a picture in our mind of where we are, of where we're speaking. So I did just a little bit of research here to see what I could discover about the history of the church in the British Isles, and it looks to me that in 1837, Heber C. Kimball, Orson Hyde, and Willard Richards went to England and landed in Liverpool at the beginning of a 4-year mission. And they had quite some success with over 300 members. And it says by 1844, and this is according to Mark Shear's Journey of a People, over 5,000 members from England had actually emigrated to Nauvoo, Illinois. And in 1845, 10,000 people attended a church conference in Manchester. That's a lot of people from 1837 to 1845. So what was the appeal of the Restoration Gospel in England?
Well, it's somewhat complicated, but I guess some of the major factors of the appeal was the message that God was concerned with each person, and God spoke today in the present age, and that was important. Beyond that, the living conditions. Many people lived in hard working conditions. Many, particularly those in Wales, were coal miners, and that was a very, very dirty, difficult, burdensome kind of job that didn't pay very much. There was a lot of unemployment, a lot of poverty. People were just looking for any opportunity for a better life. And so the gospel message brought to them hope. And as has already been indicated, that many of the members who joined in those early years were encouraged to leave their homeland and to go over to the USA, which was considered at that time a land of opportunity. There was a promise of a better life. Each church member family would be granted an inheritance with their own property. So it was just the appeal of hope for a better life that is the major theme that attracted people to the church in those early years.
As it did many in the United States, hoping for that, and it's how they ended up kind of on the frontier of this country. So we kind of move ahead, and by 1863, the first reorganized missionaries went to the British Isles. And so Charles Derry and his wife Eliza met there. Thomas Taylor. Taylor had originally gone to Utah, but had become disenchanted with Brigham Young, returned to England and became a leader of the reorganization. And in many places, this is the case, the mission efforts suffered for lack of funds. And eventually, some people came to assist Taylor in serving as a missionary in the British Isles, and that was Jason Briggs, which is a name of the reorganization that carries a lot of notice, and also Jeremiah. And I had Jeremiah. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes. Uh-huh.
Okay. And they came to assist. So are there families in England who are descendants of these early leaders still in the church?
Well, you know, I didn't have time to really research that question, Karen, but I think there are. I know that there are some descended from Thomas Taylor, but I'm afraid I can't name others that go back to the very early 1860s time period. I'll talk in a little bit about my family that came a little bit later, but that's as far as I know, but I'm sure there are others.
Okay. So are there stories about them that were kind of passed down? In the U.S., we have stories of church leaders locally in different jurisdictions that are kind of part of the cultural lore of the area. Do you have that in England?
We do, generally, and then I'll mention some specific cases. Stories of great sacrifice, people traveling long distance on foot, not as long a distance as the trek from Illinois to Utah, but nevertheless, for the British, it was long trips. Preaching on street corners and in public parks, enduring ridicule, people made fun of them. Charles Derry, an early convert in the early church, he went to Utah and he became dissatisfied. He joined the RLDS Church and he went back to Britain. A popular story that is told there was that he went to the post office to get his copies of the Herald, the Saints Herald that had been published. This was in the 1860s. And he found that there was postage due and he couldn't get there without paying. So he pawned his overcoat in order to get the money to get the Heralds.
Oh, my goodness.
There's the stories told. I mentioned my great-great-grandmother joining the church in 1879. She went from her home in Enfield to visit a cousin in closer into London. And at that time, they had some missionaries visiting in the home, holding what we used to refer to and maybe still do, cottage meetings to talk about the gospel and try to interest people in joining the church. And she liked what she heard. And so my great-great-grandmother, whose name was Mary Matilda Kemp, joined the church. And within a few years, all 11 of her children joined the church, but not her stubborn husband. He never did join. But many families of the church, people in the church today, descended from her, a well-known apostle in the church from earlier years, a few decades ago. Arthur Oakman is a distant cousin of mine, also descended from this same great-great-grandmother. Then I'll just tell briefly a story about my grandfather, whose name was John Arthur Judd. He lived in the same hometown as I grew up in Enfield, and he became an early pastor when he held the office of priest, pastor of the Enfield congregation, when that was re-established. It had been established earlier in 1881, but then had to be closed because they didn't have enough people to keep it going. But in 1903, my grandfather was involved in getting that restarted. And the stories of the fact that he was a hard worker, he owned a construction and remodeling business, but they never had much money because he spent all his money traveling around for the church and giving to the church.
So 1903 is also the year that Joseph Smith III set out to visit the church in the British Isles. And he was age 70 when he did this. And as you said, it was a long journey to go across. And so at that time, he embarked on this journey in order to elevate the importance, according to Mark Shear, of overseas mission in the eyes of church members. So I'm wondering if there are ways that you can see that this is an important way of emphasizing mission that has been used throughout the church. Did his journey to emphasize the importance of foreign missions continue and affect future missionary efforts?
Well, yes, I think it really did. Just a word about that visit. When Joseph Smith III, together with his counselor, R.C. Evans, made the trip to Britain, they traveled around and I think made a brief visit to each of the congregations. Now, there weren't that many congregations in Britain at that time. And still not a large number, it would be less than 20, but he attended a reception in my great-grandparents' home in 1903 and spoke at the newly reestablished congregation in Enfield. And every church president since then has visited Britain and indeed most of the countries where the church is established. I think that, you go back to the very earliest years, the decision to try to take the good news of the restoration to outside of the U.S., it was natural to think of England, kind of still in some sense the mother country from which the U.S. Sprang, even though a number of decades had passed by since that happened, almost a century. But after Canada, the British Isles, England, Wales, Scotland, and Ireland were an obvious choice to go. But in that sense, we were from the very start an international church, although not completely in flavor. We were a church that was established, was present in a number of different countries. We were, from those early years, always looking for new places and new countries where we would take the gospel message. So I think the visit of the president to different countries really speaks of the importance of the church outside. And as a person born in a country other than the U.S., I find myself continually, whether it's in a printed word or a spoken word, trying to raise the consciousness that we should not always be speaking from a U.S. perspective.
Very important. Thank you for reminding us of that. Even here at Project Zion, sometimes we think of ourselves as a U.S.-based podcast, and we're not. We have listeners from all over listening to Project Zion. So there's a name that's pretty well heard of in the reorganization, and he hails from England, and that is F. Henry Edwards. And in 1924, he married Alice M. Smith. And Edwards is known in church history for his position as a conscientious objector during, was it World War I?
Yes.
And he went on to be a beloved leader of the organization who influenced our theological perspective in a lot of ways. And so I know a lot of people are interested in him. What can you tell us about him?
Well, F. Henry Edwards, his full name was Francis Henry Edwards II, or Jr., carried the name of his father, was born into the church again. His birth year was 1897, but his parents had joined. His father was formerly a member of the LDS Church, his mother of a different faith. But he grew up, and as World War I began in 1914, and he was of draft eligible age, as you indicated, he had declined. He said that he would not get himself into a situation where there was even the possibility that he could kill a fellow church member who was a German. And he would... He could disagree strongly with someone, but never hate them. He observed from his earliest years that the life and ministry of Jesus was central to the message of the Restoration, and that kind of framed his life and guided him throughout his life experience. So that was pretty important for him. That was not his desire to be or his decision to not participate in the war effort was not well understood by everybody. In fact, when his name was put forth for ordination when he was about 19 years old, there were some who had a difficult time with that, but he ended up being respected for his viewpoint.
And he influenced generations of people that continues today in the life of the church about the cost of discipleship and the pursuit of peace. Right. So he has a long legacy in the church. So how did he end up then in Independence, Missouri, marrying Alice M. Smith?
Well, the president of the church in 1920 was Frederick Madison Smith. He was a grandson of the founder, Joseph Smith Jr., and the son of Joseph Smith III, the first president of the reorganization. And in 1920, Fred M. Smith took an extended visit. It ended up being longer than he anticipated, but he went to the British Isles in 1920 and stayed over, actually, on into 1921. And when he got there, he found a lot of correspondence was coming to him. He was the editor of the Herald at that time, and he needed somebody to be a personal assistant secretary. And F. Henry Edwards was available. He had had some training in actual accounting, but would be good for that kind of a job. So he was assigned to Fred M. Smith around the country. And as a result of that, he was encouraged to attend Graceland College. And he did that. He left England and went to Graceland, started studying there in September 1921, and was called to be an apostle in 1922 at the tender age of 25. So that's kind of how he made it over to the U.S.
To be called as an apostle at age 25.
Right.
So do I remember correctly, I'm trying to stretch back to when I first read about this several years ago, that he was one of the earliest leaders, or maybe the earliest leader, to attend seminary and earn a theological degree?
Well, Karen, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to correct you at that point.
Oh, no.
He did not attend seminary and did not earn a theological degree. He did attend the equivalent of high school in England and then studied to become an accountant. And then when he got to Graceland, religion was part of his studies for the first year. But then after that, he was largely self-read and self-taught. Because when he was called the following year into the Council of 12, then he was not able to continue and complete even his bachelor's degree. So he was one of several leaders of the church at that time who became familiar with a lot of important writers just by picking up books and reading them.
Oh, absolutely. And his own books, his own influence on the church continues to influence the church today.
Right, yes. In 1936, he wrote a book called Fundamentals, and it was just a basic statement about church beliefs and church practice. But later, probably 30 years later, he was urged to maybe do a revision or at least allow reprinting of that book. But he declined. He says, no, it's not fair for you to hold me to what I said 30 years ago in that book, because he was always open to explore new ways of thinking. When the church decided in 1960, which at that time he was a member of the First Presidency, to form a basic beliefs committee to take a look at the basic statement of beliefs of the church, which had dated all the way back to Joseph Smith Jr. in the 1840s, he was chosen to chair the basic beliefs committee. He also was a significant writer. I was just looking at a biography his son Paul wrote about him, and in the back of that biography, there's a long, long list of books, course books, articles in church newspapers and so on that he's written. They're very, very impressive. So he's really influenced the church. And a lot of what he says is really continues to be sound and useful to for the membership of the church.
So if our listeners are interested, they can go into just about any pastor study of one of our existing congregations, and somewhere on the shelf, there's most likely a copy of Henry Edwards' Fundamentals, if you're interested in seeing what he wrote that he didn't want to have to rewrite 30 years later. I know I've seen many of them in my travels around the church. You mentioned his... was it his son or grandson, Paul Edwards?
Son.
So F. Henry wrote the Fundamentals and then chaired the Basic Beliefs Committee. Paul wrote, was it Exploring the Faith?
No, I'm afraid not, Karen.
Oh, I'm wrong again. Which was it?
The Basic Beliefs Committee was Exploring the Faith was the book that emerged from that 1960s. Mm-hmm. Paul has written a number of books. A whole variety of different books. I can't actually pull out he wrote a little history of Graceland College, I know, one time, but he's written a number of books also.
He was a prolific writer as well.
Yep, he was.
Absolutely, and influenced the church and continued to influence the church. So when you think about F. Henry Edwards, what do you think his greatest contribution to the church was that still resonates today?
Well, I mean, a long legacy of stable leadership. His legacy was stability in the church from the 1920s to the 1960s. Very important. The biography that his son wrote is subtitled Articulator for the Church. So he did articulate and spoke. Other people would search for words and not be able to come up with what really to say about what the church stood for. He could do that very well. So I think that's his major contribution.
So the period of the reorganization that was from 1939 to 1944, when we're talking about the British Isles and the church there, that took a heavy toll on England. How did the church survive those difficult years? We talked a little bit about F. Henry Edwards and helping with the stability over what were the really difficult years in the U.S. with the Depression and World War, but England really took the brunt of that. So how did the church manage through those war years?
Well, I think you have to understand how the British have always been survivors. I mean, for centuries and centuries. In fact, the British have never been defeated by a foreign power that had taken over their soil since William the Conqueror did that in 1066. They've been attacked many times. They've been involved in a lot of altercations, but they are survivors. They were very, very resilient people. So that carried over to the church. I remember one account in my home congregation was that there was an outdoor picnic had been scheduled, but the air raid warnings went off during wartime, and they had to move it inside. And then another was that just not many yards up the street, there was an unexploded bomb landed in the middle of the street, not far from the church. But they kept going in spite of this. They're real survivors. That's all I can really say about that.
Yeah, it sounds like it. So I read that in 1965, the church purchased a Dunfield house and that it still holds camps and reunions at that, at Dunfield House. Is that where you attended reunions?
Well, no, I didn't because I left in 1961, so they didn't have Dunfield House at that time. In fact, the early reunions, the church, many of them were held in our home congregation of Enfield. From 1945 to 1959, they held there. I remember as a child the visit of President Israel A. Smith in 1952, seeing him come and be a guest at our reunion at that time. But by 1959, they then tried for several years to use rented facilities for reunions until they decided that they needed the Dunfield. I don't remember exactly the circumstances of the purchase, except that they were looking around and they found this, we refer to as an old manor house. So it would have been a family with some means. They would have owned property and this would have been their residence. And it would have been a large house. And I couldn't find the information on exactly how old the house was, but at least 300 years. Maybe there's some evidence that it was for another 100 years before that there was some kind of building, if not that building, on that property. So they looked for that. They found Dunfield, and it was available for a fairly good price, which back in 1965 was, probably the equivalent of $50,000, which would be a bargain price today. But so they scraped the money together, and they were able to purchase it. And with careful stewardship and care and maintenance, it's been conserved and some improvements have been made. Like many of the reunion grounds in the U.S., it is not only used by our church for various gatherings, but also rented to outside organizations. And the British are very proud of Dunfield House now. They think it's wonderful. And I was privileged to be present just a few years ago at the 50th anniversary of the acquisition of that. And it was a great celebration. It was really good.
As it should be. So I want to go back a little ways from where we've just been for the purchase of Dunfield in 1965. So let's go back a century. And in 1864 was what we talked about, this concerted missionary effort in England, Wales, and Ireland, and it was led by Briggs, Jeremiah, and Derry, who we had talked about, and also a man named George Rush led a mission trip to Scotland. So let's visit outside of England a little bit and ask, when did the church establish congregations in Wales?
Well, let me start with that by saying that the agenda for the early reorganization missionaries, when they went back over there in 1863, was to go to the places where there was a stronghold of membership in what we would refer to as the early church, or the Joseph Smith Jr. years. And Wales was one of those. Wales was extremely strong in those early years. And so when we talk about the thousands that traveled, left their homeland and traveled to Nauvoo and then many on to Utah after that, we're not just talking about English people. We're talking about many thousands even of Welsh. So congregations in Wales were established in 1837, just right after those early missionaries went, and also in 1863, because in 1863 they were going back. And in fact, the first reorganization area conference of the church in Britain was held in Wales. And I believe it was the first European conference. Wales is very important.
So does the story of the church in Wales differ in any way from the story of the church in England? I mean, other than towns, did it develop differently or was it fairly similar?
Well, I mean, I don't know. When I spoke earlier about the coal mining heritage and the poverty, that was more intense in Wales than it was in England. So it was that really influenced them and the hope they saw in the gospel. But also the Welsh are fiercely independent. I mentioned earlier, they don't want to be mixed up with English. I mean, they have a good relationship with English
as long as you don't call them Brits, okay. So do we know the names of any of the early church leaders that were Welsh?
Well, we do. Now, the first church official from in 1863 from the church headquarters who went as part of that initial group was Jason Briggs, who was president of the Council of Twelve and also one of the two, as it were, co-founders of the reorganization with his early experiences in the 1850s. But he went over there, and in fact, he lived some months there. But one of the things, and I'll try to, you can wave at me, Karen, if I go on too long about this, but when my wife and I, Chris and I married, I talked to her about how proud I was of my five generations of the church. And she says she just knew that her grandfather had been a member. That's all she knew. Well, through her mother and her genealogical work and reading in church history, we have discovered that in the early 1860s, two branches of her ancestors were instrumental, important leaders in the church in Wales. She always knew that her family was from Wales. J.T. Phillips was a man who was baptized into the early church. He went over to the U.S. He went to Utah, was dissatisfied. He went to Missouri, joined the RLDS Church, was ordained to 70, sent back as a missionary in the early 1860s to Wales. And that was my wife Chris's great-great-grandfather. Another line of her family is Griffiths, and they also were early members and leaders of the church in Wales in the early 1860s. So she now has at least, in fact, I think she has a sixth, I think she goes back one generation more than me. So she, in terms of her church heritage.
So how wonderful that she has served as part of her ministry in the church, also as a president of 70, in the same vein as her ancestor, J.T. Phillips, served.
Right.
That's exciting. And we currently have a member of the Council of Twelve who comes from Wales.
Right. The first one, I believe. The first one who became the first member of the Council of Twelve in our heritage from Wales.
From Wales. So that's Richard James.
Right.
So did the church ever have a viable presence or a congregation in Scotland or in Ireland?
Well, the early church did under Joseph Smith Jr.'s time. But in the reorganization, there have been four attempts to establish congregations in Scotland. None of them have been able to be sustained. but none in Ireland. There was some missionary work, but not anywhere near as significant as in England and Wales.
So when we kind of look at broadly at the church developing in the British Isles, what do you feel is the most important thing our listeners should know about the church in the British Isles?
Well, I would say that although numerically Community of Christ or RLDS has not exactly thrived over the years, in fact, the membership of around 15, 16, 1700 has remained fairly constant since I left over 55 years ago. But the church does show signs of life and creativity. New congregations have emerged as older ones have closed, and the church continues to witness vibrantly to the life and ministry of Jesus. They're really on board with Christ's mission is our mission. And new members are added regularly, not in large numbers, and leaders emerge through new members and the children and grandchildren of the old timers are there providing quality leadership. So I think it's really a good things are going well. Things are going well.
So do you have any recommended reading for folks who would like to learn a little bit more about the church in the British Isles and perhaps other places?
Well, I struggle with that a little bit. There are two histories that have been written, and I'll mention those, although I'm not sure that they are easily available. They might be available from the headquarters. I know they're available from the church headquarters library, but other than that, they're not in print anymore. One was written in 1977 to commemorate 140 years of the church in Britain, and that's titled History of the Church in the British Isles by Geoffrey Holmes. And a more recent volume titled A People of Faith, History of the Church from 1863 to 2010, written by Barry Fox. And over the years, there have been a number of Herald articles over the years. It's my ambition to write an updated and more complete history of British Isles, but I'm not sure I'm ever going to get that done. But it's a wish that I have.
Well, we can hope that you do get that done. And we can read that. And if not, if you're in the Kansas City area and want to visit the library at headquarters, that might be a good place to find some of this material available. So, Peter, before I let you go, I wanted to ask you, what are the lessons from our history in the United Kingdom that continues to help shape and form us as disciples today?
Well, I'd say Community of Christ continues to passionately pursue the mission of the church, just as it is occurring in more than 50 nations around the world. The British church is proud to be one of those, and in its own way, and appropriate to its own culture and its own, as I said, one can often think of, oh, well, England and the US should be fairly similar, but there's many, many ways in which they're different, and we don't have time to go into that right now. But in their own way and suitable to their own culture, they continue to witness strongly and vibrantly. The church over the years has provided some key leaders who have served at high levels in the church. In the RLDS Community of Christ time, there have been eight who have served as members of the Council of 12 Apostles and two in the First Presidency. And so I just think that it's very difficult to describe. And so that's why I kind of want to end with an invitation. Okay. Many who have not had the opportunity to visit the church congregations in the British Isles to do so. Many of your listeners will have made trips there on vacation, presumably, but visiting the church and getting a feel for what they are doing and what they're like and what's happening there, I can assure you they will be warmly welcomed.
Well, thank you for that. And thank you for being our guest today and walking us through the history of Community of Christ in the United Kingdom. So with that, we'll close. I'm Karen Peter with Peter Judd. This is Cup of Joe. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to Project Zion Podcast. Subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcast, Stitcher, or whatever podcast streaming service you use, and while you are there, give us a 5-star rating. Project Zion Podcast is sponsored by Latter-day Seeker Ministries of Community of Christ. The views and opinions expressed in this episode are of those speaking and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of Latter-day Seeker Ministries or Community of Christ. The music has been graciously provided by Dave Hines.